Today on Off Mic, Saturday will mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. We talked to one local reporter and what she remembers of that day and how local journalists responded. We hear from the mayor of Gary and his city's plans to mark the day. And we re-air a story from the 10th anniversary and how the war that erupted following the attacks impacted the mental health of one local service member. All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ Radio. So, obviously, we are just the day before the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. There's going to be a number of memorial services and commemorations to mark the day. And I reached out to a number of local people to get their perspectives on what they remember of that day and how are they going to remember the 20th anniversary. And I also reached out to local journalists, and one of them happens to be Lori Harvey Kegel. Lori was a reporter at the time with the Northwest Indiana Times 20 years ago during the terrorist attacks. And even though she wasn't there in New York or Washington, D.C. Or Pennsylvania, like most reporters around the world and country weren't, there's still, you know, situations where she had to go out and cover things, the news of the day, just like I did 20 years ago when I was with the Post Tribune of Northwest Indiana. But I wanted to get her perspectives, and she's in studio with us now. So Lori Harvey Kegel, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, again, looking back 20 years of that day, and I know a lot of people remember that day distinctly, what they were doing, who were they with, what were you doing 20 years ago? I mean, because remember, that morning was a beautiful morning.
Yeah, it definitely was. So I actually was not scheduled to go into the newsroom until later that evening. Generally, if you're covering, you know, a city council meeting or something, you wouldn't start until later in the afternoon. So I was asleep and living alone, single, had an apartment in Glenwood. And I got a call from my dad waking me up, and he sounded really nervous and upset and said to turn on the television. Said, there's a big story. You're going to have to go to work. So I turned the TV on just as the second plane hit the tower in New York. And as we continued to talk, he said he was flipping around the channels and saw that the Pentagon had been hit. So I hung up with him quickly. I called my editor. He was still home with shaving cream on his face, Rich Bird, who I said, where do you want me to go? I'm hearing that there may be some concern about the Sears Tower in Chicago. I think folks will remember there was concern that that might be a target at the time. And I said, do you want me to go there? And he said, yes, and then stopped and said, no, don't, because he was worried about my safety and said, just come into the office. So that's how my day started that day.
Yeah, you know, it took a while before I was doing a number of things that morning. I was still at home, and I was driving, actually, for some reason that morning. I was tuning out the news mm-hmm. that morning. At the time, I was the president of the Gary Newspaper Guild, mm-hmm. and one of my colleagues or members, had a dispute with the paper and was leaving, but there was an issue with unemployment, so I was heading from Merrillville on Cleveland Street, but heading towards the Gary Unemployment Office for some meeting. And I remember around that time, it was around the time when there was this whole thing about Michael Jordan possibly coming back to the NBA, not the Bulls, but the Washington Wizards. And I just happened to turn on the TV, the radio. Mind you, before that, when I was at home, and again, I wasn't looking at any TV, no mm-hmm. Today Show, no nothing. I was listening for whatever reason, I wasn't paying attention. And I have a brother, an older brother who's special needs. Mm-hmm. And he calls, he goes, Mike, there's a plane that hit one of the buildings in New York. I go, oh, okay, all right, But in my mind, I wasn't really taking it seriously. So I drove, turned on the radio, and they were making a fuss over something. I'm like, are they making this fuss over Michael Jordan possibly coming back? But then they started talking about the World Trade Center. And I think, I turned on the radio like a few minutes before the first tower collapsed. And this was already a while. So I was just like, well, what is happening? And I think I started listening to Howard Stern, who was on the radio, and was just captivated. And so the meeting was canceled, didn't even show up, actually, went to the newsroom. And our newsroom at the time was in Merrillville, not too far from where we're at right now. Everybody was just kind of stunned and looking at the TV, not sure what we should do. And so I guess we just started looking at the computers and started to assess where should we go. At that time, because it wasn't none of the attacks at that point was in Indiana or Chicago. But you're right. Sears Tower, John Hancock Building. And we were just kind of assess what's the next move. So how long did it take for you to get an assignment?
Actually, by the time I made it into the office, most of my colleagues were already out in the field and had been assigned because I was coming in later than I normally would have. So basically, my role at that point was stay put because somebody needed to be able to kind of man the phones, keep an eye on the wire reports. So my it was interesting. My desk in the office, I worked in the main newsroom in Munster on 45th Avenue. The television in the newsroom was positioned over my shoulder. So it was behind me on the wall and it was on mute. So I wasn't watching over and over and over again. I was watching my computer screen. I was kind of keeping up with wire reports, but I was also taking phone calls from local folks. And these calls were very different in nature. It wasn't people calling to tell us things. It was people calling seeking information. So I was getting calls from people saying, my son works in New York. Do you have a list of people who've been killed? Do you have a list of people who are injured? You know, I need you to check your list. And we had to say, you know, sir, ma'am, I don't have that. Let's get your name and number. Let's see what we can do. So that was really the bulk of my day. And I was fortunate late in the day. I was covering Calumet City in the time, just over the border, to be able to talk to the son of a woman who'd called early in the day. And he was on the George Washington Bridge. And it meant a lot to be able to call her and say, we were able to contact him. He's okay. And to be able to play that role. But I literally was at my computer all day. So I wasn't watching what the rest of the world was watching all day long. I wasn't watching things unfold. I think people have a tendency to think, but you're in a newsroom. You're right in the thick of it. But the reality is, and I'm guessing you probably experienced this throughout your career too, Mike, but you become kind of myopic. You are hyper-focused on whatever, you know, part of the assignment you have. And that's not always the big picture. And that's kind of how it was for me.
Yeah, that's true. We, you know, and actually, you know, first of all, we're humans. So, yes. And we're Americans. And we're looking at all this in real time.
Yeah.
And sometimes as a reporter, you feel kind of powerless.
Yep.
Especially when it's happening in New York and D.C. And you're thinking to yourself, but right away it starts to kick in, how can we localize this story?
Yeah.
But back then, you got to remember too, there was no social media at the time.
No. Nope.
Cell phones, yes. TV, yes. Computers, internet, yes. But no social media to like, where's this person? Where's that person? So we were trying to figure out how do we localize this? One of the first things I did, and I'm going to talk about this. I'm a little bit I'm a little bit ashamed of how I felt at the time. But the first place I went, actually, I went to the Islamic Center in Merrillville, where it was actually the mosque was being, I think it was being built, or a modern one was being built. And there was nobody there. And I was looking around, waiting to talk to people. And I got to admit, I was a little apprehensive going in there. I was a little like, oh, man. But since that time, I have come to have, at the time, I really didn't have too many Muslim friends. Mm-hmm. And sorry to say, but now I feel a huge defender of Muslims and their faith. Mm-hmm. I feel like in many ways their faith had been hijacked that day. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's not how all Muslims feel. It's feel silly to have to say that 20 years later, but it's true. And we're still going through a lot of that Islamophobia. We just got out of Afghanistan. But I would hope that people are more mature enough to say, you know, I mean, people of all quote unquote faith, Christians, everywhere, they can do extreme things. They could do extreme good and they could do extreme bad. And that day, you know, everyone felt it. But sure. I got to say, too, on September 11th, the day before, my sister just had a baby. Mm. You know, my nephew's 30, yeah. 20 to, you know, where this is airing today on the 10th, and tomorrow's September 11th. And I always say that it was the last day of America being America. I mean, we definitely switched. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for good or bad, I mean, that the country did come together.
Oh, yeah.
Because when those buildings collapsed, there were liberals in there. There were conservatives in there. There were Republican, Democrat, black, white, Hispanic, Muslims, everything.
It was the human
race. It was
race.
Everybody.
It's the human race.
And so, you know, it took a while for us to contemplate, like, what's our next step? What are we going to do now? Mm-hmm. You're frightened because we didn't know what was going to happen next. But still, having an assignment to try to localize the coverage was kind of therapeutic. Got your mind focused.
I would agree. And I would say, too, that, you know, and I'm assuming that you were doing the exact same thing that everybody else was doing. I mean, we worked 12-hour days for at least a week, if not longer. I mean, we were coming in, you know, usually our start time was around 10. And, you know, we were putting the paper to bed about, you know, 10:30 for first deadlines. It was constant. I mean, and nobody was talking about overtime. Nobody was talking about, you know, what do I need to do? Or, you know, I can or can't come in. It was just, I'm here. What do you need? And I think one of the things that happens that folks don't always think about, and, you know, you're not supposed to see the journalist in the story, right? We're just the conduits. And I still say I'm no longer a journalist, but I still kind of think of myself that way.
Once a journalist, always.
And
you were a newspaper. So you, like me, I was in newspapers for 13 years, so you still have that, what I call ink poisoning.
But, you know, we just worked, and we just worked and worked and worked. And I think one of the things that happens is you don't get to experience these things the way that the rest of the country does. Mm-hmm. And you don't really have time to process your emotions or even allow your emotions to come through because you're on to the next story and the next story and the next story. That's not to say folks need to, you know, feel sorry for us. I mean, it's a choice that journalists make and it's a noble profession. It's one I always approached as public service. You know, Ben Bradley said that, you know, journalists, I think he said it as newspapers, but in my mind, I'm gonna rewrite Ben Bradley, believe it or not. But you know that they write the first draft of history, mm-hmm. and I don't think it could ever have been more apparent in modern times than on September 11th. That's exactly what we were doing, and our stories are things that people turn to now, and those videos are mm-hmm. things that people turn to as part of history now. You know, and it's important work, but it's you do break down. you do have emotions. You know, I think the best reporters are the ones who do, you know, who do really care. And mm-hmm. you're going to see that in their coverage.
What do you remember of, like, any? Well, before we get to that, I remember you were mentioning because I know the Times office is right on the Munster-Lansing border. Mm-hmm. And you were saying one of the things that you noticed around that time that the plane stopped coming to the Lansing
yes.
airport.
Yeah, that was a really eerie. The silence was eerie. You know, those are small airplanes that come in and out of the Lansing airport there, so they're loud, right? So you hear those engines, and the runway was right next door practically. So those all stopped, and it was kind of eerily quiet. The now former police chief, Dan McDevitt, just a mm-hmm. wonderful person, told me years later that they had snipers on the roof at the airport because they didn't know what to expect.
Nobody knew because, you know, a little bit of, you know how journalists are. We turn to comedy all the time mm-hmm. to kind of lighten the load. And I remember being in the newsroom and, you know, we're like, oh, well, call local police department, see what they're doing. And I remember we got a fax or something that said, oh, yeah, The Hebron Town Hall is closed because they're monitoring. There's police out there. And, like, thank God Hebron is safe.
I know. And we, you know, there's always a little bit of that black humor. I don't remember a lot. I remember a lot of kind of just heads down work constantly during that week. And it was exhausting, but it was worth it. And this, like you said, there was not, there were cell phones, but not to the extent that they are. There was not social media at the time. It wasn't quite the 24-hour news cycle that we have.
Right.
But, you know, I think it was as close to it as our country had ever experienced up until that time. I mean, mm-hmm. all the normal, you know, all normal television, radio, everything else was kind of halted. And it really was kind of a 24-hour news cycle. I mean, you know, you would
baseball games, football games, everything shut down.
Yeah, everything shut down. And it was constant news. I mean, the anchors, like the network anchors who were on in the morning when you left for work, they were still on when you came home at night. I mean, it was just this constant cycle at the time.
And there wasn't this where you'd have a faction of, let's say, an alternative media source saying, we need the economy back up. We need it. I mean, just like a counter argument. Everybody was just in a collective state of shock. Everything was shut down. Airplanes were shut down. Mm-hmm. Travel was shut down for
schools,
at least three
work.
Or 4 days. Schools, right? Similar to the pandemic, except not with an opposing, you know, faction out there.
Right.
That's going against the grain or divisiveness.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember of a story that still stays with you in those days after September 11th, something local that you did?
The one I'll never, ever forget. It was 3 days after, I believe it was 3 days after the attacks was a national day of prayer. And I was sent to St. Victor's School in Calumet City, one of the parochial schools there. And the kids were having a prayer service. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever the kids start singing at church, that's when it really gets me. And, you know, I said we were working constantly. We were exhausted. This was an emotional time, really, for the nation. I think we were all grieving. Most of us journalists didn't have time to. We were just moving on to the next story. So, you know, all of these kids had these little sweet hand-drawn flags, you know, crayon little signs, and they were out by the flagpole and doing their little service. And I was talking to this boy, he was 13, and I said, well, you know, tell me about what's been going on. What do you think about everything? And then, you know, kind of, you know, what are your prayers today? And he said, well, you know, it's important that we're praying, and I think it's okay if we cry, but, you know, everybody just needs to know we're going to be okay. And that's when I finally broke down. And, you know, that a child could be that confident that it's going to be fine is a testament to his school, his folks, his faith. But he provided comfort to me in a way that is really hard to explain. I think I kind of needed to break down at that point a little bit and just kind of let my emotions out. That was one that stood with me because it was very personal and very sweet. There's an image from this, and I know I'd shared that with you earlier, that I can't get out of my mind, that gets back a little bit to what you were talking about you know, the Islamic Center and the Islamic faith and folks of Middle Eastern descent. There was a gentleman, and this image really sticks with me. He was a native of Yemen, an American citizen, immigrant, who owned a Marathon gas station on the west side of Gary. And a couple days after the attacks, somebody came in with an assault rifle and shot up his gas station. It was declared a hate crime. But my friend, and I believe yours too, Zbigniew Bizdak, who was a photographer with The Times and is now with Chicago Tribune, amazing photographer.
Amazing photographer, yeah.
Took this incredible photo of the bullet holes in the protective glass that saved this man's life. And that started happening in the area, well, in the nation, you know, unfortunately, at an alarming rate. You know, I mean, there was the good and the bad. I think we tend to to think only of the good when we're looking back and think of kind of those first ball games back with the Yankees and the White Sox. And, you know, I know we're both White Sox fans, but, you know, we think about kind of the, you know, the flags that were flying and the church services and the pews were full again and kind of all of those good things. But there were some ugly things that happened, too. And we have to remember that to make sure that they don't happen again.
Yeah. One of those ugly things, and I'll admit it here, something I contributed to. And I, to this day, it just bothers me because I interviewed a local doctor, a Muslim doctor. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to understand Islam a little better a lot better on how people of the Islamic faith, a Muslim, could have done this, you know. Mm-hmm. How could they fly the planes and do all this mayhem? And doctor was very nice, cordial, inviting. But I asked him a question, and the answer, and at the time when I wrote the story, it didn't even dawn on me as it was anything bad. But when it came out, people had such an ugly reaction to it. I asked him, and I had it on tape, so I didn't misquote him, and I asked him, is Osama bin Laden your enemy? And he responded. It's a leading question. But I meant, because it was an entire conversation. Mm-hmm. And he responded, first things out of his mouth, but, you know, Osama bin Laden is not my enemy. And he goes on to explain this and that. But that little quote that came out in the paper was near the end of maybe a 30-inch story, mm-hmm. which would be,
long.
I don't know, long story. Yeah. And he got hate letters, calls. He was calling me, go, Mike, oh, my God. And it was really nothing I can do about it. He said it. It wasn't misquoted, but the way people took it. And I kind of understood. It didn't dawn on me as a negative comment. Because he was such a man of faith that he can't view anybody as an enemy.
Sure.
But the way the country was feeling at the time, really, people read it. I'm not going to say they read it the wrong way, but they took it in a way that maybe he didn't intend.
If you don't have hate in your heart, you're doing something wrong. Yeah.
So if I had to do it all over again, I would cut that part out. Not to sanitize it, but, you know, to prevent any kind of backlash somebody might feel. I do remember covering a forum where, at the time, former Congressman Pete Visklosky organized between members of the Muslim faith and community members, and they all got together, and it was, there needed to be some healing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never gotten into this profession to create division,
right,
for more understanding. I'll be the first one to admit that I don't know enough of the Islamic faith. I don't know enough about Judeo faith. Mm-hmm. One of my best friends is Jewish, and every time we get together, we talk baseball. Huge White Sox fan. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a big Bears fan.
Mm-hmm.
And we both worked at the Daily Herald, but at the same time, we do take time for him to have me better understand the Jewish faith.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, it's the same thing with anything you don't understand. You want to understand it better.
You know, journalism, I was taught, is intended to inform, educate, and entertain. Sometimes it does just one of those things. Sometimes it's doing all three. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, and I don't want to get into this too much, journalists in general, regardless of the medium, just don't get the respect that they deserve. And I think that looking back on September 11th is a great example of helping folks to understand and remember how they know what they know. Where did they get this information? What is their memory of it in terms of what they were seeing, what they were learning, those images, those photographs, those videos? Those were all coming from journalists. These were not cell phone videos. These were not individuals on the street doing this. You were getting this from professional journalists around the country. Your memory is shaped by their work and continues to be. And I think that they deserve all of the respect and praise for what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say, you know, not just because I'm a journalist, but that journalists are supposed to provide you information that you need to know, not information you want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing a lot of that where people seem to want to gravitate to information that they agree with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing harder than to, you know, swallow a pill that is of bad news.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to go to the doctor and have them tell you, well, you have cancer.
Right.
You don't want to go to your kid's teacher and say, well, you know, he's failing or she's failing and they need more help. We don't want bad news, but sometimes you have to get the information.
Yeah.
You know, ignorance is not bliss.
Right.
And people go to church and, you know, the pastor has to give them, you know, a sermon that maybe they're not the best person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but it's news that you can use. It's not, you know, it's to inform. But now we've gotten so, well, we could do a whole hour on how, you know, media and things have changed. And well, let me ask you this. We are at, you know, the day before the 20th anniversary. How are you going to remember this 20th anniversary?
First of all, I can say it's so hard to believe it's been 20 years. And I know that sounds so cliche. I feel like I did the 10-year anniversary pieces yesterday. I mean, it feels like it was just yesterday. You know, I've said I didn't experience it like others did. So when I see documentaries, when I see, you know, I feel like I'm still kind of just working as hard as I can to absorb some of the other stories and some of the information about it. One of the things that I remember vividly, you know, we were talking about what stories do you remember? I remember what the other journalists did that were giving me this information. I remember when David Letterman's show came back. And it was the first night, and he said, look, I don't know how I'm going to do this, so bear with me. I just felt like we needed a laugh. And he had Dan Rather on, you know, the incomparable Dan Rather. And Dan Rather was talking about how he was thinking about the lyrics to America the Beautiful. And there's a lyric that says, thine alabaster cities gleam untouched by human tears. And he realized that's not true anymore. And he started to really tear up, and he was embarrassed, and he apologized, and he said, I'm sorry, you know, I'm a professional, I need to be professional. And, you know, Dave reached over and held his hand. He said, you're a professional, but good Christ, you're a human being. And it was almost like giving permission to seeing that Dan Rather can choke up made me feel a whole lot better about crying on the lawn at St. Victor's School with his 13-year-old. Peter Jennings, you know, the anchor, he was amazing for ABC.
Yeah, my all-time favorite journalist.
Mine too, because we always watched Channel 7. So, you know, as a Chicago kid, right? So, you know, that was kind of my station. And when he announced years later that he had cancer, he said he had stopped smoking but started again when he was covering September 11th. And he said he started because he was weak. It's like he wasn't weak, he was human, you know? And I think of those people. Of course, I think of the firefighters. I think of the police officers. I think of the Port Authority folks. I think of, you know, people. And now, when this happened, I was single. I did not have children. I'm married with a son now. It would have been an entirely different experience. I know that. You're a dad, too. I know. It would have been a very different experience.
Oh, yeah. My daughter was 4 years old at the time, and she was at home. And she was getting ready to be taken to her grandmother's house, and it was just a scary.
You just want to grab
time.
Your kids,
yeah, absolutely.
I just, you know, I think of everybody who played a role in being the good guys, and I think it's really important that people remember that the journalists were the good guys in this too.
Oh, absolutely, because they're the ones who have to convey the message. You know, recently visiting the Twin Towers Memorial, and the names of all the firemen who went up there knowing, probably not knowing they weren't going to come down, but the lives that were lost, the firemen, the policemen, the people working there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were still a number of firefighters from our area who went over there to help out. There was construction workers went out there.
Right.
And you might think, well, that's their job, but it's still... the air quality wasn't great down there.
Right.
All that, the pulverization of fuel and all the stuff that was in there, when you see the clouds, mm-hmm. That's everything that got into people's lungs. And we right. know that firefighters, even if you survived that day, your health was compromised sure. just for being down there.
Sure.
And seeing all that, people, you know, again, yes, as journalists, this is our job, but also as firefighters, the paramedics, the doctors, the nurses who had to see all that. There is post-traumatic syndrome
yep.
from seeing all yeah. that. There's only so much anybody can take. I don't care if you're a service member. I don't care whatever profession you are. If you don't feel it as a human, I mean, you're going to feel it.
That's right.
It's going to be taken in.
And so you have my to hat, give yourself that opportunity yeah, to grieve. And
my hat is taken off to the firefighters, the police, yes. all the men, because, you know, you see all the names on there, you know, men, women, you know, everybody get, you know, they didn't know that day, beautiful sun-kissed day mm-hmm. in New York City, that what was going to happen to our country. And then with Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. I don't know, this 20th anniversary. I mean, it could be the 30th, the 40th, the 50th. It's going to feel like it just happened yesterday.
Right. I mean, I think the only somewhat comparable experience in my life, I'm 51, was the Challenger explosion when I was 16. And I remember that, you know, where I was, how I heard, who told me, how I felt. You know, I think with age comes perspective, and, you know, experiencing, you know, September 11th as somebody who was 31, who'd lived a little longer, and experiencing it as a journalist was different. There will be something in our futures that's going to have a similar impact, I'm sure. And hopefully our past experiences and perspective will allow us to handle and manage as we move forward.
The only one critique I would probably give for journalists around that time is I remember specifically the Post Tribune headline. I still have it at home. And it's not a critique of the headline writer. It just was the feeling at the time when, you know, our military began bombing, you know, places in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and it's like America rising, and it's like I wish journalists at the time would have pushed back a little bit more of who exactly are we bombing, who exactly are we, I mean, because, you know, at the time we're angry, we want to strike mm-hmm. out at somebody. But, you know, as I was just explaining to my daughter a couple of days ago, that this was a different, we're so used to World War II and Korea yeah. and Vietnam that, okay, it's another country that we're battling. We were battling an ideology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we were battling not a country, not an area. And that's what people fail to understand. It was an ideology. And it's still out there. Maybe it's even worse. But I wish journalists would have just been a little bit more scrutinizing of who we're doing this to, why are we doing it, and is it the right people? And 20 years later, we're just getting out of Afghanistan.
You know, kind of speaking to that, one of the things that I remember very distinctly, the office I was working at for the Times, as we'd mentioned, was in Munster. And there are gas stations as you head west there, toward that Lansing airport, where folks from Illinois would come because the gas was less expensive. And as I was sitting in the office, you know, in the newsroom, kind of glued to my computer screen all day on 9/11, when I came out of the office that evening, there were lines and lines, long lines all down the street at all of those gas stations. There was a BP on the gas on the corner there as well, at 45th and Calumet at the time. But there were long lines at the gas pumps because folks were concerned that our petroleum supplies would be compromised as a result of the attacks. And, you know, I now work in the sustainable transportation industry that works to reduce our dependence on imported petroleum, in part because of some of the threats from a geopolitical standpoint. Also for, obviously, air quality issues and everything else. I'm getting into my new job here a little bit. But, you know, and every sign on every business, as I was sitting in the newsroom, flipped. Every sign said, God bless America. Flags were everywhere. And this was from 10 in the morning till 10 at night. And that unity, that sense of, you know, a single United States of America, you know, were they unified for something or against something? I guess that's a bit more to what you were speaking about, Michael. But, you know, there was such a sense of pride. There was such a sense of, you know, what that young man said to me at St. Victor's. We're okay. We can cry, but we're okay, and we're gonna be okay. And that confidence that we were moving forward together, you know, was, I think that's what got us all through.
Well, you are listening to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're speaking with Lori Harvey Kegel, former reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana, reminiscing of the September 11th attacks and what she was doing as a reporter. Well, we're going to wrap it up. It's been a good 20-so conversation. You got through this without crying. You thought you were going to cry.
I made it.
Well, thank you, Lori Harvey Kegel, for joining us here today on Off Mic.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much. I appreciate the work that you do and that all of your colleagues in journalism do. I think it's important to remember that on this anniversary as well.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. A number of communities around Northwest Indiana will host commemorations for the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The city of Gary is also hosting an event, and here to share his thoughts on the anniversary is Gary Mayor Jerome Prince.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for the opportunity to share some of my thoughts. But to answer your question, I remember specifically where I was. It was about 7:46 Central Time, and I was in the shower. My wife had actually just gotten out, and she was. We were both preparing for work, but in any event, she was the one who first alerted me. And, you know, sort of surreal, as I'm sure it was for many people, but I didn't believe her. I go, you're crazy. Nothing like that could ever happen here, were my first thoughts. And by the time I got out of the shower, the second plane was actually hitting the building. And yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday.
Wow. And as the images unfolded and we knew what was transpiring that day, what was your thought process as the day went on, knowing that obviously it was a terrorist attack and, a lot of people died? How did you react?
Well, I don't think you could really explain that in any certain terms, you know. Obviously, I experienced, like many folks or everyone, a myriad of emotions. You know, as a Marine, I certainly thought about my time or tour of duty. I thought about my dad who fought in Vietnam and his brother. You know, I certainly thought about all the folks who were engaged in conflicts before that. But I guess more immediately, I thought about my son, who were most in their teen years. And, you know, at that particular point, I thought about how possible it is that they could possibly be engaged in this conflict or the conflict that would result as a result of, you know, the actions that day. But also, you know, I had just a really human thought. And for my wife and I remember we sat down and just sort of reminded us of how uncertain and how fleeting life could be. And when you look at it in consideration of the thoughts that I had about my sons, and I have four sons, and the possibility of them having to serve in some particular conflict, it made us really, really just sort of refocus on how important it is to make the best of every moment that you possibly can, and particularly with the ones that you love. And so anyway, it's a pretty somber day, to say the least, and a lot of emotions.
Right, right. And at that time, the country seemed to come together in a way that I had never seen in my lifetime. And now we're as polarized as we ever been. Let me ask you this. How are you going to remember the 20th anniversary? I know the city of Gary is having a ceremony tomorrow to mark the day, Saturday, September 11th. How do you think Americans, or how are you taking this 20th anniversary?
Well, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, there's always the somber reminder on this day, but oftentimes it seems as if we forget about the fragility of that moment and what it really meant as a country. I think you nailed it when you said, 20 years ago certainly was a moment that people coming together, regardless of, different political perspectives or ideologies and that. And today, right, we find ourselves at probably one of the most complicated moments in history. I think that we certainly, as a country, have to remember times like 9/11 when we came together and just the importance of it and how it actually made us stronger. And certainly never lose sight of that.
And tomorrow, Gary is having a remembrance. What will be happening at that event?
Yeah, it's a moment of silence. I believe we're going to begin at 8:30. We'll certainly have the honor guard, color guard, post colors. We'll lower the flag to half mast and just have a moment of commemoration, certainly for those individuals who lost their lives and families who will be forever impacted by that. But also, it's a time to recognize the people who continue to sacrifice their lives, not only on a national level, and what I mean by that is our troops, but the folks who fight the fight daily here on a local basis. So it's just the time again to remember that I believe that we're stronger in unity, and that we have a responsibility to all work together to make this a better country.
And Mayor, where is that remembrance going to happen in the city of Gary? By City Hall?
Yes, it'll be right at City Hall near the flag.
All right. Gary Mayor Jerome Prince, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
One day, thank you for the opportunity. Talk to you soon.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Mike Puente. Well, the wars that erupted following the terrorist attacks took a mental toll on service members. I wanted to share with you a story I produced for WBEZ on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks about a Hammond service member whose time in Iraq proved to be too much. Friends say growing up in Hammond, Indiana, John Krasinowski was like a lot of kids, a natural-born jokester. He loved motorcycles and barbecuing. After graduating from Morton High School, he married his high school sweetheart, had a baby boy named Jaden, and was trying to figure out what he wanted to do in life.
He had talked about going into the military a couple of times, and I think I deterred him a couple of times. After 9/11, he kept saying if he walks away from it and not serves his country, nobody else would stand up.
That's John's mother, Linda Krasinowski. John went off to basic training at Fort Riley, Kansas, before heading to Iraq in 2007. He served 4 years before eventually moving back home in early 2011 to live with his mom. John was divorced by then, but started studying to become a police officer. Linda says her son seemed pretty much the same as before.
He always carried a smile. If John didn't have a smile on him, he was probably sick or there was something wrong. But other than that, he always carried a smile.
Yet something was wrong with John. His military buddies say their unit often experienced combat and tried their best to cope.
When we're in Iraq, suicide is a big deal in the military. Obviously, it's getting bigger. But we used to joke around about it a lot.
Rob McGrath, who now lives in Texas, was in John's unit and shared an apartment with him at Fort Riley.
But I took it as a complete joke, you know, oh, he's drunk, he's just trying to scare this girl.
That girl was fellow Hammond native Laura Latham, who lived with John in Kansas. Laura didn't take any of John's threats as jokes.
He did try to commit suicide twice in Kansas in front of me.
Laura says the first attempt happened after a party. John had been drinking, was depressed, and took out his gun.
I didn't know what to do because I had never seen a gun in real life. So I freaked out. I ran upstairs and got a roommate because we lived in the basement of a house with a bunch of army guys. He came downstairs and talked to John and got the gun away from them.
Laura eventually returned with John back to Hammond, where they lived with his mom. But John continued to be haunted by the war, including one battle in an Iraqi village.
He said that there was children inside the village that he took down, and that's what haunted him every single day. I mean, he would literally wake up in the middle of the night, sweating and just in panic.
John's mom heard the same story.
And said that he was so sorry for what he had done to the children. He did not mean to hurt anybody. And he said he wished he would have never hurt one child at all. He wished he would have never hurt anybody. He knew what he had to do, but...
I wasn't able to confirm this particular incident, but it seems clear that John was struggling to adjust to civilian life. By June 2011, Laura and John broke up and she moved out. A month later, with his mom away on vacation, John hosted a party. After midnight, he started texting former Army buddies and calling friends. Laura Latham says she reached out to John after seeing a troubling message.
He had put up a Facebook status with the lyrics to a song called Tomorrow. Tomorrow, you're going to let go of everything. Tomorrow, you'll move on with your life. But tonight, you're going to have like the time of your life. And I said, because that was kind of scary.
About 4 a.m., the troubled young man was in his bedroom. He put a gun to his mouth and pulled the trigger. John Krasinowski was only 22 years old.
It's one of those things where you think it could happen, but you never believe it. I still remember exactly where I was, what time it was. I remember everything. It's the hardest thing to accept. Still to this day, it's been a year and 8 months, and it's still hard to accept that he's gone, and he actually did it, but he was sick.
I lived a life of hell. I don't have my son. Losing a child to a war, to suicide, to a car accident, to anything, it's the hardest thing.
John's mother, Linda, thinks soldiers who leave active duty should be required to seek mental health counseling.
I have a grandson that has to grow up without a father now. For the military to tell me that it's not mandatory for these gentlemen, it's really sad. It hurts so bad.
Right now, free counseling services are mandatory for active duty soldiers returning from a deployment. But non-active or reserve units are not required to seek treatment, says Mark Ballesteros, a spokesman for the Department of Veteran Affairs.
The most important step for individuals is to understand they need assistance and that and for them to make that step. That's a critical kind of commitment in the treatment process.
So far, there's no effort to make the treatment mandatory for those not in active duty. And even John's own Army buddies, guys like Jared Palmer, don't agree on whether counseling should be made mandatory.
You can't be forced to go do anything. Nobody wants to be forced to do something. Nobody. They're not going to talk. They're just going to close. Just shut down.
But that's cold comfort for John's mother, Linda Krasinowski.
Wish he would have gotten help not seeking the help, I don't understand why he didn't do it or why he wouldn't do it. But that's my baby. That's my youngest. I got my older daughter and I got him. And I love him too much to be mad at him. And I'm still proud of him. I'll always be proud of him.
Tomorrow, I'm gonna leave here. I'm gonna let you go and walk away like every day I said I would. And tomorrow, I'm gonna listen to that voice of reason inside my head telling me that we're no good. But tonight I'm gonna give in one last time, rock you strong in these arms of mine. Forget all the regrets that are bound to follow. We're like fire and gasoline. I'm no good for you, you're no good for me. We only bring each other tears and sorrow.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. You can hear this episode again as a podcast by visiting lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, and the staff here at Lakeshore Public Radio, thanks for listening. Have a great day.